hello, ladies and gentlemen. Doc Wyatt here, your humble host. Proud to be humble. Another edition of the Conservative Underground Show. Thank you for being here this wonderful day, wherever you happen to be. JFK in memorial, knockout attacks in the youth culture, filibuster no more, first signs of the end of the Democrat Senate majority, voter ID, Obama approval at an all-time low, Obamacare delays in the Iran nuclear option, all of this and more on this edition of the Conservative Underground. Sit back and relax, I'll do all the work. Welcome to the broadcast, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you all for being here. Broadcasting here from beautiful Broadcast Park and bunkered in the palatial Studio B to avoid the NSA and drone spying of the Obama administration. I am Doc White. Thank you for joining me here on the Conservative Underground. You know, ladies and gentlemen, on this previous Friday, November 22nd, we observed a significant event in the history of the United States, the 50th anniversary of the assassination of President John F. Kennedy. I, of course, was not alive 50 years ago, but I have, probably like many of you, parents, family members, friends, what have you, who were. And I can tell you that growing up, this was always a topic of discussion around the dinner table, Friday nights, card night, Saturday night, card night, whatever, family coming over. There would, on most occasions, be political conversation going on, at least in my household, and from time to time, there'd be the talk of the Kennedy assassination. Now, in my household, the Camelot storyline of the Kennedys was very much believed and very much honored. You know, ladies and gentlemen, it was a significant event. And, you know, I believe that unless you're, 60 years old, you really don't appreciate the impact that a tragic event like that would have on yourself, on your communities, on your outlook on the world. And I don't want to spend a whole lot of time talking about this here today, but I think it's important that we just step back for a moment and appreciate the significance of the event. You know, on Twitter, there was this handle that was at JFK Elm Street. It's still out there. And I followed it for much of the last year leading up to the 50th anniversary on November the 22nd. And periodically, they would tweet out events that occurred on whatever particular day it was 50 years ago, leading up to the assassination and then the events afterward. And throughout this past year, and then including today, I just gained a new respect for the significance of that event. You know, unless you were around to live history, to live those historical events, you can't really appreciate them until perhaps maybe you invest yourself a little bit into reading about them. I can tell you that me personally, the images of that assassination, as graphic as they are and will remain with me now as looking at this over this commemoration, very graphic, and will stay with me. For the American people to see their president gunned down in such a horrific way, in considering the relative innocence of society at that time, I'm sure contributed to the feeling at the time, the helplessness, the insecurity. And, you know, ladies and gentlemen, this was really the face of a generation. the Kennedy presidency, however that happened, it really has become the face of a generation. Now, I will say this, that John Kennedy was far more conservative than what a lot of liberals want you to know. And I have two clips here that I think demonstrate that. But John Kennedy was certainly far more conservative. Conservative on taxes, conservative on national security, than what the Democrat Party certainly is today, and what a lot of liberal historians would have you believe. So while I am able to, 50 years later, to the benefit of history, read the information that's available to us at JFK Elm Street on Twitter is a great source. It's sponsored through westwingreports.com. I do have a greater appreciation of the impact on society. To see the children, to see the widow, to see the graphic nature of the event. And that presidency was the face of that generation. That event defined the post-World War II baby boom generation, without a doubt. And it's important to also note that I think, contrary to what a lot of people believe in our from our teachings, you know, John Kennedy was not assassinated by some right-wing political nut. John Kennedy was assassinated by a Marxist, by someone who was anti-government, a communist, a sympathizer of Fidel Castro. This Lee Harvey Oswald was, you know, one could argue, mentally unstable, but was clearly driven by an ideology that actually is very similar to what drives many people. I think of the individual who shot Gabrielle Giffords, the Columbine people, the shooters there, the Newtown nut that shot up the school close to a year ago. I mean, these are people that were just really checked out, and what political ideology they did have was of a revolutionary nature that is found more prevalent on the left than what you see on the right. So, more conservative JFK than liberals want you to know. I have a clip here. We're all very familiar with this clip, but let's analyze it under a different context, if we could.
And so, my fellow Americans, ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country.
Now, why is that significant? That's one of the more famous quotes. That's certainly one that you hear along with "the torch has been passed to a new generation." Ask not what your country can do for you, but what you can do for your country. Now, think about that. Do we have that sort of mentality prevalent in our society today? Certainly not within the framework of the modern Democrat Party. There is a sense, ladies and gentlemen, of an entitlement, that you are owed something by simply being born an American, and that government would guarantee that fairness and guarantee that entitlement, whether it be through health care, whether it be through, food stamps or unemployment or some sort of benefit that the society pays for to give to you to help make up for the fact that maybe you don't have what the guy next door has or something. These are all ideas that are foreign to the founding of the Republic. These are ideas born out of Eurostatism and the progressive liberal movement that far predated by maybe 50 years John Kennedy. But the one thing that our political parties had in common at one time was that basic belief that Kennedy just espoused right there, that we shouldn't be asking from our country all of these things we should be giving to our, what we could do for our country. Now, perhaps the more impactful quote that you don't really hear a lot. You don't really hear this next passage from Kennedy's inaugural address. You know, we hear a lot about going to the moon, and as I say, the torch has been passed, and ask not. But to me, this is my favorite Kennedy quote. This is a man who recognized the grave threat that communism poised to the United States and to the world, and to the world community. So, again, this is the one quote that certainly you would not hear at a Democrat rally or at a Democrat convention. And this is, by all accounts, the popular icon of the Democrat Party, President John Kennedy, at his 1961 inauguration.
And yet the same revolutionary beliefs for which our forebears fought are still at issue around the globe. The belief that the rights of man come not from the generosity of the state, but from the hand of God.
Now think about that. There is a Democrat president talking about the rights of man are not inherent to the state. That is a rejection of communism. It's a rejection of the Euro-style socialist state that was spreading across the continent at the time. And what we see today as its aftermath, bankruptcy and moral decline, moral decay, and a complete surrender to the governmental unit. Kennedy correctly identifies that is not what America stands for. Now, you won't hear these quotes often from liberals and people quoting Kennedy in the media and such, but they're out there. And finally, ladies and gentlemen, the myth of Camelot. The myth of Camelot. We all have sympathy for Jackie Kennedy. Our heart goes out to when we see the pictures of her in mourning 50 years ago. It still is very powerful. And the children. But make no mistake about it, ladies and gentlemen. You know, the public relations spin machine soon began after that fateful day in Dallas. And it wasn't to necessarily distort history and what the Kennedy presidency was and who he was as a man. I think it was more designed to distract. Camelot was never a term that was used to describe the Kennedy presidency until after it happened. And again, I'm not suggesting mischievous means here by Jackie Kennedy or the Kennedy family or such things, but really, the Kennedy presidency wasn't all that we think it was. By and large, it was amateuristic mistake after amateuristic mistake. But what it also was showed the resolve of not only the American people, but of our leaders at the time. And I think Kennedy's resolve in facing some of these crises is where he recognized his failures and fell back on his core beliefs of America, which is what I think is what is absent today with the current administration. I do not think President Obama has an affinity for the United States like John Kennedy or the generations before us. I think Obama's view of the United States is one of typical progressive liberals, the grassroots of the Democrat Party, and that is what I say, more of a resentment, more of an entitlement, that they're owed something to fundamentally change injustices that they perceive. But that's what I think would have propelled Kennedy to perhaps a second term in 1964 had he lived, was that he still was, at its root, a belief in a traditional American exceptionalism. And the people, I think, were eager to rally behind this face of a generation, this young, invigorating person, but he was deeply flawed. And you can't help but think, at least in my opinion, that perhaps Jackie Kennedy knew that someday his infidelity would come out, that what was his personal faults would come out, and that she felt that that could not tarnish, should not tarnish his reputation. So the myth of Camelot began. And America certainly was not all hunky-dory back then, and the Kennedy presidency was not one success after another. It stumbled out of the gate, and often. Over in the blotter, below the podcast that you will see is a clip from ERA News, A History of the Oswald Family. It is a good piece about, you know, Lee Harvey Oswald had two daughters and a wife that continued to live in Texas. And growing up, one can only imagine, growing up, the children of the man that shot President Kennedy. Can't imagine what that life was like. So there is a story in the blotter, KERA News, Oswald Family, and also the YouTube clip of the Kennedy inaugural in the police blotter section. So, significant event in American history, certainly the face of a generation, more conservatives than what liberals would want us and you to know, but also important, the myth of Camelot, the rocky Kennedy presidency, and certainly I think it's fair that we now begin to, as historians begin to dissect, that we have an honest accounting of who he was as a person. So those are all very important. And I think when you are not afraid to investigate who someone was, the good and the bad, that if you're not afraid to do that, you'll have a true definition of who the person was, the person's presidency, and an understanding of why things happened, without all of this public relations and without all of this distractions. And that doesn't always mean that you'll think less of a person. Perhaps maybe you'll appreciate the person a little more. All right, folks, let's take a quick break here. You're listening to the Conservative Underground. When we come back, a lot more on the agenda. Tell a friend to tell a friend about the Conservative Underground.
When friends don't stop friends from drinking and driving. Friends die from drinking and driving. Friends die from drinking and friends don't let friends drive drunk.
Kramer, I've been reviewing your work. Quite frankly, it stinks.
Well, I've been having trouble at home, and you know, I'll work harder, nights, weekends, whatever it takes.
No, I don't think that's going to do it. These reports you handed in, it's almost as if you have no business training at all. I don't know what this is supposed to be.
Well, I'm trying to get ahead.
Well, I'm sorry. There's just no way that we could keep you on.
I don't even really work here.
That's what makes this so difficult.
You're listening to the Conservative Underground. I'm Doc Wife. Thanks for listening. You can email me at conservativeunderground1776.
But a lot of people are afraid to call me when they're experiencing chest pain or to call 911 if they're with someone experiencing chest pain. You know why? Because they think it would be embarrassing if it were a false alarm. Instead, people risk permanent damage or death because they're afraid they might get a lecture. That's ridiculous. So if you have an uncomfortable pressure, fullness, squeezing, or pain in the center of the chest that lasts more than a few minutes, call me. If you have a pain that spreads to the shoulders, neck, or arms, call me. If you have any discomfort in your chest with lightheadedness, fainting, sweating, nausea, or shortness of breath, call me. If you have any of these symptoms or are with someone who does, dial 911 right away. And if it is a false alarm, I'm not going to give you a lecture. I'll be happy to see you. I would much rather treat someone who isn't having a heart attack than to try to save someone who is. To learn more about heart attack warning signs, call the American Heart Association at 1-800-AHA-USA-1 or visit us on the web at AmericanHeart.org.
Even a chain smoker can quit smoking. In fact, over 36 million former smokers have unchained themselves and quit for good. This free booklet is full of tips on how many of them did it. Call 1-800-4-CANCER. 1-800-4-CANCER. It just might set you free.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Conservative Underground. Thank you for being here. Thank you for listening. That's not the right one. Oops, that's not it either. That's not it. Boy, we could be in for a rough go here.
Well, look me up.
Thank you, Liberace. Well, I don't know what happened to that Big Three news theme that we have. We just got done talking about John F. Kennedy and Memorial. I'd like to thank my Deputy Chief of Staff over here, Brent Myers, for screwing up the sound clip poor again today. Let's see. Well, that one works. Thank you very much. So, any event, the Big Three there, the JFK Memorial. Next, I wanted to touch on these knockout attacks in the youth culture. And I have on the blotter, the AKA the show notes, a link here to this website, NBC News. I don't know if you have been paying attention to this or not, but apparently there's this new fad in our culture, our youth culture specifically, and specifically in urban areas, it seems, that people, young people, are just going up to folks on the street and cold cocking them, knocking people out. They're calling these knockout attacks. And over at NBC News, Daniel Arkin, a staff writer, does a pretty good expose on all of this and stating in his story here that authorities across the country are investigating whether recent random and unsettling attacks on pedestrians are part of a game called Knockout, in which teenagers try to knock unsuspecting passerbys out cold with a single wallop. Police say teens have made sport out of lobbing punches at strangers for years, and it's primarily a pastime for rowdy young boys trying to impress their friends. But the moronic activity has taken a deadly turn, with at least two fatalities tied to knockout stunts this year, amid evidence of a surge of similar assaults in New York, Pennsylvania, New Jersey, Massachusetts, Illinois, and Washington, D.C. Illinois is Chicago, no doubt about it. Jeffrey Butts, a psychologist specializing in juvenile delinquency, told the Associated Press that it's hard to excuse this behavior, no kidding. There's no purpose to it. When someone runs into a store and demands money, you can sort of understand why they're doing it, desperation, whatever, but just hitting someone for the sheer thrill of seeing if you can knock someone out, sort of childish. In September, in Jersey City, two 13-year-olds and a 14-year-old were charged as juveniles in the slaying of Ralph Eric Santiago. He was discovered September 10th with his neck snapped and his head struck between iron fence posts, according to the Associated Press. The county prosecutors have said that they believe the accused teens were playing knockout. Additional attacks have been in Syracuse, New York, where a pack of teens trying to knock out Michael Daniels, 51 years old, with one powerful punch, ended up beating and stomping him to death, according to news reports. And a 16-year-old was eventually found guilty of manslaughter in Daniels' death. Also in May, Alex Murphy was sentenced to life in prison plus 25 years in St. Louis for killing a Vietnamese immigrant as part of the game in 2011. In Lower Marion, Pennsylvania, a suburb of Philadelphia, two recent attacks may be related to the knockout game. So I don't know what's going on around the country. It almost makes you think, you don't even want to go outside and go down the streets if you happen to be in one of these large communities, these large, more urban settings here. But you have to sit there and go, is this part of the video game culture? Are we seeing people consciously or subconsciously acting out a video game? You know, obviously in Newtown, and we're coming up on the year anniversary of that horrible tragedy, the killer there was motivated by video games. Scoring, he was schizo. He confused the video games with reality and believed that if he went into a school and shot up a bunch of kids that he would you know, obtain all of these points in this game of life or whatever. I mean, he was a nut. You take a look at these knockout attacks and the youth culture that we have. What role is video games playing in all of this? The fact that, you know, you and I could sit down when we were growing up and play video games for a few hours on end, and you'd have your mom or your dad or somebody would yell upstairs, you know, turn that video game off. You know, your eyes are going to go buggy. Go do something. Do something outside. Nowadays, the video games are much more realistic. Parents are much less inclined to interject after hours of playing the games. And they've almost become like role-playing games where people really become part of the game. And if you sit and you play that kind of stuff enough and you're exposed to this violence for multiple hours a day, several days in a row, it can have an effect on you. And we're out there trying to, you know, get at guns and get at other sorts of things that are perhaps indirect causes of these violent acts. But in reality, we need to look at our culture and we need to see what our kids are spending their time on. And when they're immersed in these video games where it's violence after violence, I could see how this would have an attack. So the blotter will have the NBC News story, Knockout Attacks on the Rise. That's the show notes segment that is below the podcast in the show website. You can find this broadcast, conservativeunderground1776.blogspot.com. And, you know, parents have to step up to the plate here and start to monitor the kinds of things that their kids are bringing into their home, whether it be their music, their style of dress, who they're hanging out with, the kinds of video games that they're playing, what sort of things are children spending their time on. And if you've got a kid out there and he's spending, you know, 10 hours up in his room with the door closed doing Lord knows what, and you're just happy that he's not downstairs bugging you, you might have a problem on your hands. It's not normal for young people not to be out socializing with other folks. What is it that they're on the internet talking about? What is it that they're on Facebook posting? Who is it that they're being friends with? How are their grades? What, you know, all of these questions and more, have parents, you have to step up here and take ownership of your child. The government's not going to raise your child. Your neighbor's not going to raise your child. Your school's not going to raise your child. You've got to raise your child. And, you know, for my money, a lot of these movies that are out there, I saw a report the other day that PG-13 movies now, today, would have been rated R when the system came out, you know, in the mid-80s. That there's now more gun violence in these movies that are rated PG-13, and they should be rated R. I mean, when I was growing up, rated R, buddy, you weren't getting into that one. PG-13 was pushing the envelope. So anyhow, I think this is... What do you do? You're walking down the street and some guy comes up and cold cocks somebody. I mean, this is the crazy, who gives a crap culture that we have going on in many pockets around the country. And it's got to stop. We can't continue to raise children to that we just ignore. And we got to quit looking for other people to solve these family problems, these societal problems, these community problems. Government can't do it. Schools can't do it. So I mean, I don't know. It just seems to be that it's one thing after another. You're listening to the Conservative Underground. We'll take a quickie break here when we come back. The filibuster no more. The first signs of the end of the Democrat Senate
majority.
We'll be right back.
What I remember most was the loneliness I felt, the separation from other people. At the end, drinking was no fun for me. Since I've started to attend AA meetings, the greatest gift is that I've become reconnected. I'm part of life again. I really like myself, and that's wonderful. AA is a miracle in my life. Alcoholics Anonymous. It works. Look us up. Check your phone book, newspaper, or AA.org.
This is Sheriff Buford D. Justice of Texas.
Texas? You know, of course, that you're out of your jurisdiction. I suggest that you let my department handle the situation.
That's very comforting. But I'm in a high-speed pursuit. Don't you hear good?
I hear perfectly. The fact that you are a sheriff is not germane to the situation.
The goddamn Germans got nothing to do with it.
What do you say?
Shut up and shit at a time.
All right.
You're listening to the Conservative Underground. Doc White here. Feel free to email me over at conservativeunderground1776@gmail.com. conservativeunderground1776@gmail.com. More
my
coming
life
up.
Was going downhill fast. Everybody was on my case. Now, I kept hoping that life would change real soon. I knew drinking too much messed up my life. A friend suggested I check out AA. It worked. I found myself in an AA group. Finally, I've got my act together. Alcoholics Anonymous. It works. Look us up. Check your phone book, newspaper, or AA.org.
Gosh, Darlene, it sure is amazing how much we have in common.
I know, Larry. We both love three-car pileups. We both were built in Buffalo.
And we both know wearing safety belts helps save thousands of lives.
Yeah, this is fascinating.
Don't mind Vince. He's getting over a bad breakup.
I know. Janet's picking up the pieces, too. They're in here.
I wish they understood it's all worth it to get people to buckle up.
Hey, lacerated lovebirds, I sense a major crush.
You could learn a lot from a dummy. Buckle your safety belt.
Talk about head over heels.
Unfortunately, there is one thing that stands between me and that property. The rightful owners.
80.
30.
50.
Every mile brings us closer.
25.
Every mile in a city near you.
75.
Help us stop diabetes.
100.
Join the Tour de Cure.
60.
Register to ride.
36.
Or sponsor a rider.
50.
Call 1-888-DIABETES or visit us online at diabetes.org/tour. How many miles will you ride?
25.
Welcome back to the Conservative Underground. Thank you for being here, ladies and gentlemen. Doc White, your humble host, proud to be humble. We are found over at conservativeunderground1776.blogspot.com. That's where you can access the website and all the articles that are written by yours truly on whatever particular issue. I've got one that I want to post up there about the Iran deal, the other nuclear option of the past week. It appears that the President of the United States and this country, Secretary of State Kerry, are willing to accept, and I guess the international community are willing to accept, that Iran is a threshold nuclear nation, and Israel and many others around the world are scratching their heads as if to say, what the hell kind of deal is this?
You trademark is stupidity.
You know. Yeah. I think we're going to rue the day. Actually, well, we'll get into the Iran thing later, but I do want to just direct people to the website and to Facebook. The Conservative Underground has a web page there. Please take the time to like it and appreciate all of your support. So the filibuster no more. On the show blotter, I have four articles here, one from the Heritage Foundation, the New York Times, two from the New York Times, and one from the Daily Caller. And I want to start with the New York Times, if I could. But let me just say, let me kind of review here what actually went down. So basically, and I have this up at my website, this show post, one of the posts here entitled, Ladies and Gentlemen, The Nuclear Option. I remember that when Ed Sullivan used to say, remember that? I'd see the reruns, but ladies and gentlemen, the Beatles. Well, that's sort of how I feel about the recent events in the United States Senate. And if you haven't heard the nuclear option, then just let me explain briefly what I'm talking about. In the federal Senate, you have several procedural hurdles that need to be met before you can vote on most, if not all, non-budgetary legislation. There are 100 senators, and that's, for those of you in King County, Washington, that's two from each state. There's 50 states. I know President Obama has been somewhat confused about that in and of itself, there being something like 57 states. But in right, in any event, when a bill is being considered in the Senate, you have to file a cloture vote, and typically that's done by the minority leader, and that's when they decide it's time to end debate. A vote is taken, and if 60 senators vote to invoke cloture, then there is a limited amount of time left to debate the bill. After such time expires, the bill is voted on then, up or down, by the entire Senate. And this second vote only requires 51 votes to pass the bill. And the same rules apply for various nominations, judicial and otherwise, from the president, where the advice and consent is required per the Constitution. So there has always been a certain amount of politicking, of jockeying, surrounding some of these more controversial presidential nominations, especially on the judicial nominations, and that's what we're talking about here. We're not talking about lifting the cloture rule for legislation. We're talking about lifting the cloture requirement, 60-vote requirement for nominations. And Republicans and Democrats are both equally guilty of playing, these games. Equal is certainly in the eye of the beholder. However, under President George W. Bush, the Democrats took the art of the filibuster to a new level. Several of the Bush judicial nominations were getting, quote, held by Democrat senators. That means they were being held. They weren't being processed. There was objections. The Democrats were clearly attempting, in those days, remember Miguel Estrada, to halt these nominations so more conservative judges wouldn't be appointed. The judiciary has proved to be a valuable tool for the Democrats. What's the motivation? Well, same-sex marriage, abortion, prayer in schools, just to name a few, have all benefited the more liberal positions favored by the Democrat Party, not to mention the big one in 2012, Obamacare. The Democrats have a vested interest to continue their attempts to control the judiciary, or at least a large part of it. Seeing this for what it was, purely politics, several members of the GOP majority at that time in the Senate suggested a nuclear option, which would have eliminated the 60-vote threshold to proceed to an up or down vote on judicial nominees. The GOP majority would be able to bring nominations straight to the floor and pass them with one simple vote with 51 senators. Now, the Democrats went nuts, and so did their allies in the left-wing media. The GOP was going to destroy the country if they exercised this option. Those evil, dirty, right-wing nuts. So here's a few sound clips. I might add these are from the current president of the United States, Barack Obama, when he was a senator, the current vice president of the United States, Joe Biden, and the presumptive Democrat presidential nominee, Hillary Clinton of 2016, all speaking on the Senate floor and speaking against the Republican attempts to exercise this nuclear option in 2005. Take a listen first up.
The American people want less partisanship in this town, but everyone in this chamber knows that if the majority chooses to end the filibuster, if they choose to change the rules and put an end to Democratic debate, then the fighting and the bitterness and the gridlock will only get worse.
So that was Barack Obama. Changing the rules, the fighting and the bitterness in Washington will only get worse if this happens. Well, it didn't happen. Did the fighting get worse? It sure did. Here's Vice President Biden. Now, obviously,
a single most significant vote
and educated
any one of us will cast in my 32 years in the Senate, and I suspect the Senator would agree with that. And we should make no mistake. This nuclear option is ultimately an example of the arrogance of power. It is a fundamental power grab by a majority party, propelled by its extreme right and designed to change the reading of the Constitution, particularly as it relates to individual rights and property rights. It's nothing more or nothing less, and let me take a few moments to explain that. Folks who want to see this change want to eliminate one of the procedural mechanisms designed for the express purpose of guaranteeing individual rights, and they also, as a consequence, would undermine the protections of a minority point of view in the heat of majority excess. We've been through these periods before in American history, but never, to the best of my knowledge, has been any party been so bold as to fundamentally attempt to change the structure of this body.
Fundamentally change the structure of the Senate. That's Vice President Biden in 2005 as a member of the Senate when the Republicans were toying with the idea of the nuclear option. And why were they toying with it? Again, ladies and gentlemen, it's because the Democrats had taken the art of the filibuster and blocking presidential nominees to a new level. They claimed 95% of the nominations were going through. Well, that was when they counted the lower courts. When it got up to the appeals courts and the Second Circuit, which is a very important court in the federal system, the judiciary system, they were conferring a far less amount, a lower percentage than 95. But the Republicans were going along with 99% of Barack Obama's nominations to the federal bench up until they exercised the nuclear option this week. And you've now heard the current president, Barack Obama, the current vice president, Joe Biden, all say that this was a power grab that would fundamentally change the way the Senate operates and is anti-constitutional in their view. But they just did it. Now, the best comes from Senator Clinton,
and basically
again,
said, change
in
the
2005.
Rules. Do it the way I want it done. And I guess there just weren't very many voices on the other side of the aisle that acted the way previous generations of senators have acted and said, Mr. President, we're with you. We support you. But that's a bridge too far. We can't go there. You have to restrain yourself, Mr. President. We have confirmed 95% of your nominees. And if you can't get 60 votes for a nominee, maybe you should think about who you're sending to us to be confirmed. Because for a lifetime appointment, 60 votes, bringing together a consensus of senators from all regions of the country who look at the same record and draw the same conclusion, means that perhaps that nominee shouldn't be on the federal bench. But
well, there you have it. Hillary Clinton's words. If you can't get 60 votes, you shouldn't even be on the bench because you don't have cross-section support in the Senate. That's apparently a problem that they feel Barack Obama should not be burdened with. And then from the New York Times, the liberal Bible, in 2005, in an editorial, the Times wrote, "The Senate of all places should be sensitive to the fact that this large and diverse country has never believed in government by an unrestrained majority rule. Its composition is a repudiation of the very idea that the largest number of votes always wins out. The members from places like Rhode Island, Maine, or Iowa know that their constituents are given a far larger say than people from New York simply by virtue of the fact that each state has two votes, regardless of population. Indeed, as a recent New Yorker article pointed out, the Democrat senators who have blocked that handful of judicial nominees actually represent substantially more Americans than the Republican majority that wants to see them passed. While the filibuster has not traditionally been used to stop judicial confirmations, it seems to us This is a matter in which it's most important that a large minority of senators has a limited right of veto. Once confirmed, judges can serve for life and will remain on the bench long after Mr. Bush leaves the White House. And that's really what they're afraid of. The lasting impact at that time of Bush nominees on the federal bench. And that's exactly what they're trying to ensure now by exercising this nuclear option, is they have a president that will nominate the most left-wing judges they can find, many of which may have a hard time getting 50 votes, let alone 60. And that's what they're trying to ensure. The Times closes out this editorial in 2005 speaking against the nuclear option by saying, "There are few responsibilities given to the executive and the legislature that are more important than choosing the members of the third co-equal branch of government. The Senate has an obligation to do everything in its power to ensure the integrity of the process." So, to the New York Times in 2005, it was about preserving the integrity of the process. To Barack Obama in 2005, it was about fairness. Hillary Clinton, it was about having broad-based support. To Joe Biden, it was about honoring the Constitution. And all of these things was a power grab. But, lo and behold, here's what we have. Well, let me just say, John McCain then has his fingerprints all over this. His folks came to the rescue in 2005. The Republicans were set on going through with this nuclear option. But McCain's band of out-of-touch hobbits brokered a deal. The GOP would get some of their nominations. The Democrats held up some of those they objected to the most, and the nuclear option was shelved. In recent years, since the Democrats lost several seats to take them under 60 votes, they have revived the nuclear option talk because, horror of horrors, the GOP, now in the minority, was doing the same thing as the Democrats did, but to a lesser extent. Now Harry Reid has had enough. The nuclear option was employed. The Democrats have the ability to now pack the courts with whomever they want, since the GOP can no longer stop the more liberal left-wingers. The Democrats are clearly the hypocrites in all of this. It really isn't the end of the world. This entire episode was long in the making. At some point, this was going to happen. But we can thank John McCain for punting it off until the Democrats, who care little for rules, pulled off the maneuver. And I want to emphasize it there, my personal opinion. Look, this was going to happen. The way that elections are, you know, and the ideology that are behind the Democrats and behind the lack of it, really, behind some Republicans, this was going to happen. One way or another, we were going to have this nuclear option. And it was either going to be the Republicans doing it first and passing those nominees that they want to pass, or the Democrats doing it later. And that's what happened. And we can thank John McCain for whatever radical liberals are appointed to the bench in the next year. Now, of course, the left-wing media is silent. No cries of the end of the democracy or of a dictatorial majority are coming from the New York Times. The bias of these folks could not be more clear than on this one particular issue, and there are others. So, folks, the only way we can overturn this is by winning the elections in 2014 to take control of the Senate. That's it. That's how we do it. In some ways, the nuclear option was already employed, though, by Harry Reid and the Democrats, and it occurred when the Democrats forced Obamacare health government-run insurance through the Senate with just 51 votes, calling it a budgetary matter. Now, I'm convinced that Harry Reid pulled this trick out of his bag for two reasons. One, to nuke the GOP efforts to protect the courts from left-wing judicial nominations. And two, to try to move Obamacare off the front page. Now, Harry Reid will succeed in the first instance, but nothing will stop the pending meltdown of Obamacare. Though we can see just how far the Democrats will go to move the ball. And I have a funny feeling we ain't seen nothing yet. The end of this liberal left-wing majority in the United States Senate cannot come soon enough. Now, let me check on the time here. What kind of time? All right, I'm going to have to take the last break of the broadcast. But the key points here, this is all designed to take Obamacare off the table, to push through as many judicial nominees as possible for the Democrats between now and next year. Because I honestly believe That was another quote. I honestly believe that they think they're going to lose this thing. And they need to pack the court for the next year as much as they can. You're listening to the Conservative Underground. We'll be right back.
In tough economic times, even a trip to the grocery store means balancing healthy family meals with the need to keep expenses down. For a healthy, balanced diet, you need a good mixture of protein, carbohydrates, veggies, and whole grains. Keeping your costs low means cutting back on restaurant food and most prepared food in grocery stores. A whole chicken goes for only about $2 a pound. A pound of beans will set you back a whole $1.50. Potatoes! Look at these complex carbs at 89 cents a pound. What this means is cooking. Bust out those cookbooks. And remember, the best part of home cooking is the leftovers. Don't ignore packaged foods entirely. You can find great deals on items like albacore tuna and bristling sardines, which are not only cheap, but a great source of protein and essential fatty acids. Visit cheapcooking.com or sardinediet.com.
Hey, Sam. Hey, back from the Denise Decathlon, huh? Got another gold medal in the broad jump?
Yeah, you got a big mouth, Clayton.
Hey, happens to be right, you know. Yeah, it's a genetic quirk in the Clavin family that we all have two extra teeth. Hey, you see, that's the only way that we can prove that we are the rightful heirs to the Russian throne.
Hello in there, Cliff. Tell me, what color is the sky in your world?
You're listening to the Conservative Underground. I'm Doc White. You know, I'm on Twitter. That's right. I'm on Twitter at Doc White, W-Y-T-H-E.
If a fire breaks out in your home while you're asleep,
that you need to stay informed. We'll be right back.
Smoke and heat build quickly, making every second count. A working smoke alarm can alert you to the danger and make the difference between life and death. Install and maintain a smoke alarm on every level of your home. Replace the battery every year. This message is brought to you by the United States Fire Administration, your local fire department, and this radio station.
What if we got rewarded for every good decision?
Dinner. Meal needs a vegetable. Check.
Amazing!
Vegetables cooked with a healthier oil instead of butter?
Fantastic!
Replacing bad fats with healthier fats like those in canola or vegetable oil is good for your heart. Take up the challenge for good health because the you of the future will say,
fantastic!
Visit heart.org/facethefats. Canola Info proudly supports the American Heart Association's Face the Fats campaign.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Conservative Underground. Thank you for being here. Doc White here, your humble host. Last segment of the broadcast. Thanks for hanging out with me during this 60 minutes. Appreciate it very much. You can hear the show over at the 405 Radio Network on replay. You can download it for free and listen for free while supplies last. Over at Podomatic, you can get it from my Facebook fan page or directly from the webpage, conservativeunderground1776.blogspot.com. So, the filibuster, no more. I believe it's the first signs of the end for the Democrat Senate majority. You have everybody on record, the New York Times, Barack Obama, Joe Biden, Hillary Clinton, the entire Democrat leadership team against the nuclear option when the Republicans wanted to do it. And now that they're in charge and they, I believe, see the end of their rule in the Senate, they want to jam as many nominees through in the next year as possible. And look, it's not so much that it's the worst thing in the world to have happen, but it is the fact that the people who are doing it happen to be hypocrites on this particular issue. And then I saw something from the White House that was tweeted out where Barack Obama said, well, you know, if a majority of folks are for something, it should pass. And you sit there and you go to yourself, what little understanding does this president really have, you know, over how our country works? And it is, majority rule, but there are minority rights. The majority doesn't get to rule with an iron fist. And that's the sort of Chicago gangster-style government heavy-handedness that this president comes from, you know? And we saw it in Obamacare. We saw it in the stimulus. And now we're seeing it with this nuclear option. But unfortunately for the president and for all of us, there was this other nuclear option that came down in this agreement from Iran. And look, I just want to say this. I'm going to spend another broadcast talking about this as well. But it appears to me that, you know, when people announce a deal and they don't announce the terms of the deal and they tell us what a great deal that it is, you have to begin to scratch your head. And you have to scratch your head and ask yourself, what is this? And look, I got to be perfectly honest with you. Where does this Iranian deal come from? It was sprung on everybody. It was sprung on the Israelis. And there may have been some behind-the-scenes negotiating for a time. But when they rolled this thing out, everyone was told, well, this is a game changer. We've struck a deal. We're now talking. We're going to avert all these problems. And then slowly but surely, some of these finer points of life of the deal are announced. And what we have here, it appears as if they're caught in the middle of the negotiations, that this deal is only in effect for 6 months, and they're passing it off as a good first step. That's what they're passing this off as. And really what it is, it's a diversion. It's a diversion on Obamacare. It's an attempt to get the president some good press. Because, look, the deal is Iran can continue to produce, at the end of the day, can continue to produce uranium. And that is the first step towards getting a nuclear weapon and the enrichment process. The president of Iran, that everybody likes now, is saying, we can continue to enrich. The Secretary of State, John Kerry, is out there. The enrichment is not a part of this deal. So on a very key issue, both sides are saying different things. The negotiations of a deal haven't stopped. The point is here, folks, they haven't even reached a deal. So Iran can continue to have their facilities. They can continue to enrich uranium, but they have to promise to do it at a much smaller rate, and they have to reduce the enrichment percentages of the uranium that they've already produced to get it under from 20% down to a more acceptable level. Apparently, the lower the enrichment level, the less likelihood it is for that material to be used in a nuclear bomb, or for, they're not weapons grade enrichment. It's more for what the Iranians are saying that they're using it for peaceful purposes. Yet they continue to enrich, and they continue to enrich attempt to enrich at a higher percentage, which leads you to believe that they're doing this for weapons stuff, for weapons development. So, you know, that is now able to, that's the deal. They can continue to enrich. The power plants don't get shut off. What they have isn't neutralized and removed from the country. And Israel's going, this is a bad deal. And you know, as I said at the top of the show, I would agree. It appears as if the Obama folks, and able to get some bad press over Obamacare off the front pages, are willing to allow Iran to be recognized as a nuclear threshold country. And they're willing to blow up the rules in the Senate to get Obamacare off the news coverages and to get people talking about the nuclear option. They're willing in their other nuclear option in Iran to do all this stuff. I mean, these people are desperate. And one thing that we've learned from the Obama folks is they will do anything. Now, we didn't get to the voter ID law story, and we didn't get to several other important issues, but that's what Trump says.
The party's over. They say that all good things must end.
And as always, may the road rise up to meet you, may the wind always be at your back, and may the sun shine warm upon your face and rains fall soft upon your fields. And until we meet again, may God hold you in the palm of his hands. Good day, everybody.